All right. So before I get started, I just want to start with a kind of not so funny story, but funny story. I fell flat on my face on a tennis court yesterday. So if you notice all the scabbing on my face, that's what that's from. And I also managed to sprain my jaw. So if I'm not speaking clearly or not pronouncing things correctly, give me a little bit of leeway there because I'm not working with my proper mouth today. So apologies in advance with that. All right. So today we're going to be talking about politicians in petticoats, the women of the abolitionist movement. And I'd like to start this discussion with the same preface that Mrs. Lydia Maria Child started with in her 1833 publication called An Appeal in Favor of the Class of Americans Called African. Reader, I beseech you not to throw down this volume as soon as you have glanced at the title. Read it if your prejudices will allow, for the very truth's sake. If I have the most trifling claims upon your goodwill, for an hour of amusement to yourself or benefit to your children, read it for my sake. Read it if it be merely to find fresh occasion to sneer at the vulgarity of the cause. Read it to sheer curiosity to see what a woman who had much better attend to her household concerns would say upon such a subject. Read it on any terms and my purpose will be gained. The subject I have chosen admits of no praises on my country, but as I generally make it an object to supply what is most needed, this circumstance is unimportant. The market is so glutted with flattery that a little truth may be acceptable if it were only for its rarity. I'm fully aware of the unpopularity of the task I have undertaken, but though I expect ridicule and censure, it is not in my nature to fear them. A few years hence, the opinion of the world will be a matter in which I have not even the most transient interest. But this book will be abroad in its mission of humanity long after the hand that wrote it is mingled with the dust. Should it be the means of advancing, not even one single hour, the inevitable process of truth and justice, I would not exchange the consciousness for all of Rothschild's wealth or Sir Walter's fame. So those are some very strong words in defense of what she was writing. And Mrs. Child alienated many of her faithful readers with the piece, as up until that point, she had published writings much more in line with the traditional women's realm, such as The Mother's Book and The Frugal Housewife. But she was not the first nor the last woman to take a stand against slavery through whatever means she had available to her. Women from all walks of life, rich and poor, black and white, northern and southern, spoke up about this issue that started out as a male political opinion, but turned into a hotly contested social matter for all. Now, most women didn't start out by announcing their feelings towards slavery quite as strongly as Mrs. Child did, however. Women were not formally admitted to the earliest abolitionist societies, which were organized and operated primarily by well-educated men. But many women, both black and white, still found a way to help shape anti-slavery discourse by aiding fugitive slaves and circling anti-slavery literature. In this photo, you see one of the earliest groups of Philadelphia abolitionists, which surprisingly was also the first that did accept women into their ranks. Now, some of these were the wives and daughters, as you would see in this image, of the early male abolitionists. They could speak more openly about their opinions, but many who supported the cause remain unnamed and unrecognized, as they had to operate within closed circles or even completely in secret. There are many accounts of escaping slaves whose journeys were assisted by housewives, some of whom simply offered food or shelter for a night. While these simple deeds may not seem like much now, and probably didn't seem like much to the women who were offering their help, they laid the foundation for what would later be called active abolitionism. They saw the humanity of the people rather than the color of their skin and felt compelled to help them, possibly without even fully understanding the full effects of their actions. By the 1820s and 30s, however, women's involvement in the abolitionist movement began to change drastically as they openly entered the discourse, eventually reorientating both anti-slavery activism and reform culture. Women's roles first became more visible within the anti-slavery struggle when several women wrote and published abolitionist essays, which led to others leading an array of abolitionist petition drives to state and federal governments, turning the anti-slavery cause from a humanitarian effort to a social matter. As I mentioned at the beginning, one of these early authors was Lydia Maria Child, who you see here. An eager religious learner while growing up in Massachusetts, though without a formal education, she now primarily, if at all, is remembered as the author of the Thanksgiving poem, Over the River and Through the Woods. But in her own time, she was a famously radical abolitionist. Using William Lloyd Garrison's publication of the abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, as inspiration, she threw her support to Garrison and the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society and began to write for the cause. Maria later recalled that Garrison got hold of the strings of my conscience and pulled me into reforms. Old dreams vanished, old associates departed, and all things became new. Outspoken in her condemnation of slavery, with the career-altering publication of an appeal in favor of that class of Americans called Africans, she pointed out slavery's contradiction with Christian teachings, describing the moral and physical degradation it brought both upon the slaves and the owners. She didn't spare the North from her criticism for its share of the responsibility for the continued acceptance of the system. But she was seemingly ahead of her time, and the public did not respond well to what were considered her very extreme views for the time. Sales from all of her books fell off, but that didn't stop her. More abolitionist tracts and stories followed. This did earn her some positive influence, however, as from 1841 to 43, Child served successfully as editor of the National Anti-Slavery Standard, the weekly New York newspaper of the American Anti-Slavery Society. She wrote in her first editorial, "Such as I am here, ready to work according to my conscience and my ability, providing nothing but diligence and fidelity, refusing the shadow of a fetter on my free expression of opinion from any man or body of men, and equally careful to respect the freedom of others, whether as individuals or societies." Child resigned her post after only 2 years as editor, however, due to her differing ideals from Garrison. She had built the Standard circulation as a family newspaper and felt it would alienate, she had built the Standard circulation as a family newspaper and felt it would alienate the audience she wished to reach when Garrison advocated staying out of the government, even to the extent of refusing to vote as a protest against union with the slaveholders. With her separation from the newspaper, she also separated herself from the movement, but continued writing with, quote, "the Negro's soul and mind," as she struggled to find an organized faith that also acknowledged the struggle of slavery, both for the blacks and for their white masters. A contemporary of Miss Maria Child, who was inspired in much the same way, was Maria Stewart. There we go. She was born in Connecticut, though became an orphan at a young age and was taken to the home of a clergyman as a servant. She was paid modestly for her role in the domestic servant position, but put most of her earnings towards learning to read and write. But after the death of her significantly older husband, only 3 years after their marriage, she was left close to penniless since his estate went to the businessmen who served as his executors rather than to his widow. Stewart turned to religion as a comfort in the aftermath of this experience. And at the same time, it spurred her to desire to play an active role in improving societal conditions. Much like Child, Stuart responded to William Lloyd Garrison's call for contributions to his abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, in 1831. She submitted several essays for publication and also began delivering public addresses, which, relying heavily on biblical references, called for the end of slavery and the elevation of women in American society. For both women and African Americans, she emphasized the importance of education as critical to gaining social equality. Her first speech to the African American Female Intelligence Society of Boston was delivered to an all-female audience, but she later spoke to audiences that included men as well as women. She later moved through New York and Baltimore, working as a teacher and serving on a staff of Frederick Douglass's The North Star, another abolitionist newspaper. For the next 40 years of her life, Stuart continued to pen and publish speeches and essays, becoming an important part of the growing abolitionist movement, and was one of the stimuli to the women's rights movement. Child and Stuart weren't the only women at this time that couldn't grasp the connection between their strict Christian upbringing and the moral inconsistencies that slavery stirred, as well as the connections between the strife of the slaves and the inequality of the genders. Angelina Grimke and her sister Sarah, who you see here, were two of the first women in the United States to publicly argue for the abolition of slavery. And they had a very unique perspective on the issue, which I'm going to hopefully switch to a YouTube clip that will show you a little bit more through the joys of PBS. Give me a minute Hang on, I think I stopped screen sharing. Technical difficulties. Thankfully, they didn't have this in the Civil War.
South Carolina's first families, Angelina Grimke lived in almost unimaginable luxury. In the 1820s, Charleston's aristocracy was one of the wealthiest societies on earth. But Angelina found it almost unbearable. An empire of sin.
The story goes that each of them in the family had their own personal slave behind them when they ate dinner. And if the salt and pepper were next to the person sitting next to you, you didn't ask them to pass it. Your slave got it from his slave and gave it to you. There was nothing that you had to do that there wasn't a slave who took care of it for you. Did you hear last night?
Yeah, what?
Really?
Angelina, what are you talking about?
Henry, he whipped John again.
I told you before, dear, that's Henry's business.
Angelina attacked slavery, not in the beginning because she cared about the slaves.
Henry's business.
You know, she was really concerned about the fate of their white masters.
You to leave him alone.
He's my brother.
Yes, I know.
She believed slavery was a sin and that God would punish people who had slaves.
Mother, it is my duty to bear testimony.
Angelina, mind your own business.
It is my business, and it's your business too. How can you stand in church every week?
Let it be.
I can't let it be. Have you no Christian feelings?
Yes, Angelina, I have Christian feelings, and you are putting them to the test right now. My soul will be judged by the Lord and not by you or anyone else.
It is my duty.
It is not your duty, Angelina. I'm glad, I suppose, that you are so diligent about your faith. But leave my soul to me and Henry's to Henry.
Speak the truth in love.
Enough.
Angelina's religious search was tortured. She was more or less on her own as she struggled with very deep and troubling issues about herself and her relationship to God.
In the fall of 1829, Grimke resolved to leave Charleston and the pollutions of slavery for an uncertain future in the North.
There's a kind of fearlessness about Angelina Grimke. Women did not strike out. White women did not strike out on their own in this way, and Southern white women certainly did not. This is disobedience to proper society, to the South, to the church.
That explained her life, or her early life, a lot better than I could have. Oops. Uh-oh. Okay. So the video kind of leaves off as she's leaving South Carolina. And the one thing that the video doesn't bring up is her sister, Sarah. And the two of them worked very closely and had eventually came to have very similar understandings of what they believed to be the abolitionist cause. So once Sarah and Angelina had left South Carolina, Angelina wrote a very lengthy address urging all women to actively work to free Blacks. While it was compelling for many of its female listeners, the sisters' lecture elicited violent criticism, because it was considered altogether improper for women to speak out on political issues. This made them acutely aware of their own oppression as women, which they soon began to address along with the abolitionism. In addition to being two of the first white Southern women to discuss slavery openly, they were also two of the first to address the oppression of women. Angelina continued her work as an abolitionist. Oh dear, thank you for letting me know. How do I fix that? Let's see if I can re-screen share. Sorry, I thought it would just flip with what I was showing on my screen. Is that better? Thank you. Thank you to IT support. All right, let's see, where was I? Angelina continued her work as an abolitionist, but Sarah, with the support of her sister, went on to insist on the importance of equality for both women and Blacks, and became a major leader of the women's rights movement, challenging all conventional beliefs about a woman's place. Another lady to embrace the idea of equality for both women and Blacks was Prudence Crandall, who we see here. Though born in Rhode Island, she was also given every opportunity to succeed in life from an early age, much like the Grimke sisters, because she attended the New England Friends boarding school, which provided her an education similar to most men, if not more so than most men. And this is despite her being a woman. Her route to helping the abolitionism cause took a different route, however. In October 1831, Crandall opened a private girls' academy in Canterbury, Connecticut, and it soon became one of the best schools in the state. She dedicated herself to women's education and felt that every girl should have the opportunity to learn to improve herself through understanding more than just the practical skills of reading and writing. This was her school that we're showing here, that's still standing and is now a museum. This understanding of wanting to teach girls more than what was commonly given to them is what led her to what is considered her most pivotal decision. In 1833, Crandall admitted an African-American student named Sarah Harris. parents of her other white students demanded that Crandall expel Harris. Crandall ignored the protests and allowed Harris to stay in school and continue her education. Since Crandall did not expel Harris, parents began to remove their students in protest, and the original school began to fail. This didn't bother Crandall, who decided to organize a school for African-American girls instead. This newly revised school opened in April of 1833, and the townspeople responded by making rude comments, throwing rocks, eggs, and manure, and refusing to sell Crandall the items she needed to run the school. Crandall was forced to have goods shipped from outside the town in order to keep her school running. Later in 1833, the town members of Canterbury held discussions about shutting down Crandall's school, and in a town vote decided to protest. Despite the strong opposition from those around her, Crandall's school thrived at first with the help of William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of the Liberator, who placed advertisements for the school in his anti-slavery newspaper. The school was not destined to last long, however, because in 1834, the state of Connecticut passed what would become known as the Black Law, which stipulated that schools could not teach African Americans from outside the state of Connecticut. Created in part because of Crandall's actions at her school, she was arrested for violating the law, but the case was later overturned due to a technicality. This did not stop the townspeople from continuing to harass Crandall and her students, and after a violent mob attack that destroyed the windows and some of the furniture in her school, Crandall had to admit failure and close the doors of her beloved institution for the safety of her students. She eventually married and moved to the Midwest, and while she continued to teach students from their home, Crandall closed the doors of her beloved institution for the safety of her students. She eventually married and moved to the Midwest, and while she continued to teach students from her home and gave speeches about women's suffrage and tolerance, she was never able to reestablish her dream of reopening her private girls' academy. Though Crandall's dream died in the 1830s, the movement of women joining and speaking out about the abolitionist cause did not. By the 1840s, Black and white women both served as anti-slavery lecturers, editors, fundraisers, and organizers. Slaveholders fumed at the women's activism. The Southern Literary Messenger was a periodical published in Richmond, Virginia, whose aim was to stimulate the pride and genius of the South and awaken from its long slumber the literary exertion of this portion of the country. In a review of the abolitionist women's writing on the subject, the Literary Messenger referred to them as politicians in petticoats, who needlessly stirred up trouble on that slavery issue. Yet, despite this harsh criticism from the South, even some male abolitionists were chagrined by the women's activism before the Civil War. In 1840, the American Anti-Slavery Society divided over women's role in the movement, with some conservative reformers refusing to support female lecturers or leaders. Nevertheless, women's activism continued to grow more intense over the next two decades, making the abolitionist movement a much stronger and more ramifying entity on the eve of the Civil War. One of these highly controversial and influential women has become a well-known figure in the history books when she was credited with creating change in the hearts and minds of the average American. Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, became an essential weapon for abolitionism due to its extremely realistic and humanizing representation of the slavery experience. What began as a short serial for the Washington anti-slavery weekly newspaper, The National Era, it grew Stowe to celebrity status, with legend claiming that even President Lincoln greeted her in 1862 as the little lady who made this big war. But she didn't start out intending to influence the world with opinions on the anti-slavery movement. And this is where I'm going to bring up another lovely PBS clip.
spring of 1833, Harriet and two friends crossed over the river into neighboring Kentucky. She had never before visited a slave state.
We have this fine specimen here. What do you get?
25?
50? We got 50 going once.
50 going twice.
50 sold to the gentleman here. How you gentlemen doing this nice and warm Kentucky day? Gonna keep this thing going?
Stowe sees there is a human thing. She sees these people. I mean, they are human beings. She's confronted with it in such an intimate way. And I think that never leaves her.
Harriet Beecher Stowe, who's probably one of the best known abolitionists because she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, was a young mother who lost her son, and her son Charlie died of cholera, and she kind of connected that loss, her loss of her child, with a slave mother's loss of their children. And she wrote the book that really changed the hearts and minds of many Americans, because she put slavery in really human terms. She really humanized the experience of slavery for many Americans, and really won over people in writing that book.
Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin shortly after one of her children had passed away. But she had been sort of, it had been bubbling in her for quite a while. And after her son passed away, she poured all of that emotion and life and energy into the book. I think she said that she didn't even feel as though she was writing it. She felt like somebody else was sort of giving her this message to put onto the page. Hopefully people who watch the show will take away from it the sense that she was a real person, and that I think it's easy for the humanity of historical figures to sort of get lost over the course of time, but that she was just an ordinary woman who was able to create a piece of art that then genuinely had an effect on the world.
So that was very clearly an advertisement for this larger series. But it kind of gives you a good insight into Harriet Beecher Stowe's life in a way that you don't often see, because there was a lot more to these women than just their activism and abolitionism and their beliefs. There was always an understanding behind them. And for a lot of women, we don't have documentation of what drove them to these opinions. So that's why I really like that clip, because it really shows how deeply Harriet Beecher Stowe was influenced by things in her own life. Another woman who was also deeply influenced by things within her own life and led her to the abolitionist cause was Frances Harper, who was an African-American woman born in Baltimore to free parents. She was raised by her uncle, the abolitionist William Watkins, and was educated at the Academy for Negro Youth, where she absorbed many of her uncle's views on civil rights. At the age of 14, she worked in a Quaker household and was welcomed to use their library to encourage her literary aspirations, which spurred her to write a collection of poems and stories, which were published in newspapers and as a volume. But her actions in the abolitionist movement didn't start or end with poetry. After the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 no longer made it safe for free blacks to live in Maryland, Frances fled from her family to Ohio and then back to Pennsylvania, where she joined the Pennsylvania Abolition Society and took an active role in helping escape slaves along the Underground Railroad to Canada. She continued to write, and in 1854, her poems on miscellaneous subjects attracted notice and became her biggest commercial success. In these poems, she attacked not only racism, but also the oppression of women. Most of the earnings from this and her other books went directly to help free the slaves. At this time, she also began her lecturing career. She was much in demand on the anti-slavery circuit, and she traveled extensively in the years before the Civil War, mostly due to her clear and easy way of speaking. As shown by this quote, which was taken from a letter she wrote that was supposedly smuggled into John Brown of Harper's Ferry Uprising fame into his prison cell. In the name of the young girl sold from the warm clasp of a mother's arms to the clutches of a libertine. In the name of the slave mother, her heart rocked to and fro by the agony of her mournful separations, I thank you that you have been brave enough to reach out your hands to the crushed and blighted of my race. Oops. Sorry. While not widely recognized today, there were many Black women, in addition to Harper, who wrote, taught, and spoke about their experiences in the world. Now we want to move forward. There we go. This is Mary Ann Shad Carey, who was another one of these activists. She was born in the slave state of Delaware to free African-American parents who were dedicated to abolitionism. When she was 10, the family moved to the free state of Pennsylvania due to retaliation against their status as free people. There, she was able to attend school, became a teacher, and actively worked with her family to help freedom seekers until their participation in the Underground Railroad became even more dangerous after the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act. For her own safety, Mary Ann moved to Ontario, Canada, to join other Black Americans who left the United States. It was there, with this group of people, that she began to write and lecture on the importance of freedom. She also opened a school for both Black and white students to attend together. And she became the first Black female newspaper editor in North America when she published Canada's first anti-slavery newspaper, The Provincial Freeman. When the Civil War broke out, Carey returned to the US to help recruit soldiers for the Union Army. And with the connections she made working with the Army, she enrolled in the first class of Howard University Law School after the war. She attended class at night and taught the local children during the day, eventually becoming the first African-American female lawyer, though she was never allowed to actively practice law. Instead, she continued her work as a political activist and writer with the articles in the local African-American newspaper, The New National Era, and gave public speeches to encourage African-Americans to work together to recover from the blight of slavery. She was also an influential force in the founding of the Colored Women's Progressive Franchise Association. Yet another Black woman who grew to fame for her speaking and writing on the subject of abolitionism was Sarah Reman, who made her first speech against slavery when she was just 16 years old. Her father came to the United States from the West Indies, and her mother was born free in Massachusetts, and between them became very prominent in the fight against slavery, providing a haven for escaped slaves on their property. Sarah grew up in Salem, a town that was exceptionally early to admit Black students to elementary school. But when she and her sister passed the entrance exam for a new girls' academy, despite meeting the school's qualifications, they were rejected because of race. This prompted her and her siblings to move to Rhode Island, where they attended an all-Black private school. Following her extended exposure to education, she continued to pursue learning outside of the school and joined the Salem Female Anti-Slavery Society, soon following her brother, Charles Lennox Reman, into lecturing for the anti-slavery societies. She made her first public speech in 1842, 2 years after Charles had met Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and other abolitionist women at the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. It was very uncommon for women to engage in public speaking in this era, and Charles's exposure to these Quaker women, whose standards were much more equitable, probably raised his awareness of his sister's abilities. Sarah Reman spent the next decade organizing opposition to slavery in an era when such a huge economic change remained controversial, even in the North. Integrated audiences were also controversial, even in the Quaker meeting halls that she most prominently spoke in. And Reman showed real courage when, at the age of 27, she tried to sit in the white section for an opera at Boston's Howard Athenaeum. When an angry policeman shoved her down the stairs, she boldly sued the city for injuries caused by the police. And surprisingly, a jury of white men awarded her $500 for her trouble. The 1853 case drew national attention and greatly encouraged white abolitionists to speak out against her treatment by the police. Some of those abolitionists were then beaten to death by pro-slavery mobs for their support. Due in part to her notoriety after this event, the American Anti-Slavery Society hired Remond in 1856 to travel nationally, and her speeches met with less hostility as she went further west. Traveling without a male escort also defied the era's moral codes, and in doing so, she helped break another barrier for women. Increasingly aware of the barriers of being female as well as Black, she joined Susan B. Anthony and others at the annual convention of the Women's Rights Society in 1858. But she would not attend the following year, however, as in 1859, she made the biggest move of her life when she went to England at the request of the American Anti-Slavery Society. She was the first Black person that many Britons had ever seen, and she took her responsibility as a representative of her people very seriously. Always described as refined in behavior and dress, she nonetheless stood up for her beliefs. She again drew more publicity later that year when the American Embassy in London denied her a passport to France. Again, she fought and prevailed, and in the process attracted an increasing number of admirers to her cause. She was forced to remain abroad with the beginning of the Civil War, but she rendered a genuine service to the Union by continuing to speak in Europe. Because Southern cotton was vital to British textile mills, businessmen there wanted to enter the war on the side of the Confederacy. Many Southerners believed that these powerful interests would persuade British gunboats to crash the Union's blockades of ports such as New Orleans, and thus force the North to allow the Southern states to secede. Sarah Remond spent the war reminding Britons that ending human bondage was much more important than a temporary economic setback, and is credited with influencing the tide of the war. A common thread you might have noticed between several of these stories is the influence of the Quakers and the events of the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. Lucretia Mott was an influential figure in both of these circles, and her thoughts and ideas had a hand in furthering the argument of abolition and suffrage. Considered a powerful speaker by her contemporaries, she dedicated her life to speaking out against racial and gender injustice. Mott was raised in Massachusetts as a Quaker, a religion that stressed equality of all people under God. In addition to helping get her widowed mother out of debt, Mott, along with her supportive husband James, argued passionately and actively for the abolitionist cause as members of the American Anti-Slavery Society. And Lucretia was one of the founders of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society. Much like Sarah Remond and others, Mott was constantly criticized for behaving in ways that were not acceptable for women of her sex, but that did not deter her. In 1840, Mott, along with other prominent figures such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were chosen representatives of the United States to the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. The men who controlled the convention, however, refused to seat any of the female delegates, which is different than what this photo or this painting shows. They were added back in later due to an uprising about the original version of the painting. Side note. this refusal of entry angered Mott, as well as the other women delegates, and she responded by pledging to work diligently for women's rights. This joint experience of the ladies there was the seed that grew into the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention. While Mott's focus shifted slightly to suffrage issues, she continued to speak widely on the abolition of slavery throughout her career, and she supported the rights of Black Americans to get an education and to vote. All right, so while my research was focused on the participation of women, specifically in the abolitionist movement, you probably noticed that almost all of the women that I mentioned moved on to also have some part in the suffrage movement, and backed equality for gender as well as equality for race. It's easy to see how support for one grew from support of the other within the arguments of freedom, rights, and simply recognizing each other as human beings. However, while all of these women and a few men, had put aside their differences in support of the Union cause during the Civil War. The differences in, the differences in opinion between them came to a head in 1869 with a well-documented schism within the American Equal Rights Association, where sides were taken as to whether gender equality, led by Susan B. Anthony, or race equality, led by Frederick Douglass, should come first. This was a debate that continued throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th century. And if I started talking about that, we would be here all night. So, I would like to finish with Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman speech from December 1851, which sums up the arguments for abolitionism as well as gender equality in a very unique way. Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that 'twas the Negroes of the South and the women at the North all talking about rights, and the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this talking about now? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me, look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns and no man could heed me. Ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's that they call it? A member of the audience whispers, intellect. That's it, honey. What's that got to do with this women's rights or these Negro rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and from a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they is asking to do it. The men better let them. Obliged to you for hearing me, and now old Sojourner ain't got nothing more to say. So with that, I ain't got nothing more to say. Thank you, guys. Comments? Yeah. Eventually, yes.
And did they ever go back south or have any contact with their family in South Carolina?
That was never really mentioned, because I don't believe so. I think as soon as they left the Carolinas, they were kind of done and they were outcast by their family. Especially as you saw in the clip, the mother and their oldest brother were very, very much the traditional Southern traditionalists. Yeah.
How did Brittany's sisters work to go to Philadelphia and live all that time? Where did they get their money from? Did they get it from the plantation or where?
Yeah, so there's a story that is not necessarily fact, but I couldn't find anything that contradicted it either, that Sarah actually encouraged her personal slave to steal her mother's jewelry. And so when the slave got punished for stealing from them, he was sold off, but really he escaped with the girls. So I'm assuming selling off some of that jewelry would get them quite a ways, but I'm not entirely sure if that's true or not. It's somewhat of a rumor. Yeah.
When I had been given to understand that the churches was going to strategy, there was a lot of bitterness on both sides. And that nobody ever really
Yeah. Yeah, that would make absolute sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I think part of what is going on in the 1850s is developing a kind of romantic notion of freedom that appeals to women in the United States at the same time that there is this sense, this John Brown sense of heroism, you know, being a fighter. And so you have this combination of speaking to women through romanticism and men through the image of the hero of the battle.
Yeah, that's actually a really great observation. That's absolutely true. And it wasn't just women in the U.S. that were being moved by this romantic notion of freedom and, you know, the betterment of women. It was women across Britain and across all of most of Europe. It really appealed across those that listened. Yeah.
Just a follow up on that. It was, you know, in art and whatnot, that was the romantic period.
Yeah.
Europe as well, so I can understand it. But my question is, you know, knowing Lucretia, sort of like the godmother of suffrage, giving us a lot, all these individual people, what influence did she have with the group? Let's say, I suppose she had, I guess I'm partially aware that she had some influence on this Susan A. Billy and others, but how do we put this together in terms of a woman's abolitionist movement, if there was one?
Yeah, there was never anything really formalized. There was a lot of female anti-slavery societies that would go back and forth with conversations and an understanding about how women fit into this movement. And in doing my research, I started trying to piece together this timeline of, okay, she was here in this time, and then she was talking to these people, and this person was in that audience, and it got really, really confusing. So in particular regards to Mott, she was a big influence in both the abolitionist and the women's rights movements. But I think her biggest influence was definitely in the women's rights realm of that. She was one of the major leaders with Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Yeah. And, but she was in the Quaker movement, and so it wasn't really her specifically in the abolitionism, but the Quaker women as a whole were really, really behind this idea of everyone should be equal, whether that's your race, your gender, your economic status. So I think just having that behind her was part of that. I don't know if that answered your question. Sorry, I went on a tangent.
Here, I mean, there is strength
in numbers.
Why is true female support, especially women like the group teacher, who are wealthy,
and
they may not have wealth for the sadly productive people, some of the society, etc.
He's.
We all understand the women's role was not the same as men, but they're strength in numbers and trying to establish this movement. And of course, there's temperance.
You got a lot of different aspects of this whole society starting to pick and choose what their lead role was going to be. And Garrison's a really interesting character because he keeps popping up, especially at the beginning, as having direct ties to all of these individuals and individual women and being really supportive of them publishing in his newspaper or editing his newspaper or advertising in his newspaper. And I think, just from my reading about him, this is just my own personal opinion, that he kind of saw himself as this overarching figure that tried to help everybody move this single message forward. So it definitely was sort of that strength in numbers idea, because he saw his newspaper as the vehicle that all of this information could be widespread. So he kind of picked and chose which people he wanted to help spread their message of. I know it goes a lot deeper than that, but yeah, he's a very interesting character that definitely pops up a lot in the early abolitionist movements for both women and men across. Anybody else, or are you just sick of listening to my voice? Because that's perfectly acceptable too. All right, thank you. Okay, good, I'm glad. I was really thinking my voice was gonna give out there for a minute, so.
All right, well, once again, thank you so much for the support that everyone has shown both in person and on Zoom over the course of this year. I really do appreciate everybody's support, so thank you so much. Look forward to seeing those of you that are going on the tour and look forward to seeing you again in September. Thank you so much. Thank you.